Tonight we finish. Amazing. You know, I never said this to you, but countless times in my life I've started teaching these notes and for one reason or another never finished. It's the first time I think I've ever actually finished. I didn't want to say that at the start. But now, now that we're actually finishing. So for me it's like I know the first part of these lessons a lot more than I knew the last. But look, isn't that interesting? This last section. And there was some discussion with Biraj last week as to whether or not the order in which we have shared these notes, in which I have them here, is actually the order in which Swami taught them. I have no recollection anymore. These things, these notes came to us in this really bad Xerox form years ago, and then got carefully retyped, and they've just sort of existed as a little pile of paper. And I have no idea what order they're in, but apparently there's another order, an alternate order to this one, which whether it's because somebody dropped them on the floor and then just picked them up differently, because I wrote pencil numbers in here. So if anybody else knows anything about how it was actually ordered, it doesn't really matter, because in the end you have to know everything. And in the end you learn as you learn and you use it as you can, and there really is no starting point, as we often say. It's not linear, it's just a circle. So, but what this is about is divine tests, tests and temptations, and it's extremely interesting, and to me it seems like an extremely good place to leave the story. As I'm fond of saying, and this course is really a marvelous example of it, there are really fundamental things that we need to know on the spiritual path that make the difference between whether 25 years from now we're still on the path and whether we're still going strong. I mean, some of us may not be in this body after 25 years, but nonetheless, we'll still be on the path, exactly, and we'll still have our attitudes in the astral world, and the more deeply we've ingrained within ourselves these ideas, the more powerful we'll be. And absolutely dealing with tests and temptations, which sort of all sort of come in together, and actually having a really good understanding of what they are, because Swamiji frankly says in here, that when you get on the path, sometimes things get more difficult. I've always been very careful not to say that, but there he is saying it frankly, so maybe my efforts to try to cover that up. Because what I don't like about that is I don't like people thinking that getting on the spiritual path is causing their life to be worse, when in fact the karma's there anyway. But he throws some interesting things in, so stay tuned and we'll come back to them. Swamiji says that a test, and you know, I don't personally, I mean, the word test is helpful. Everyone develops preferences in their lives about how they discuss things. And sometimes people become preoccupied with the word that everything is a test. And it becomes a kind of negative orientation toward the spiritual path, that everything, little thing that happens is a test that you have to face. So for that reason, I have not favored that word. The positive side of that is to realize that everything happens as a test. And it's a test of your faith in God and your devotion to God, and that nothing is really a problem. Nothing is really a bad experience. Everything is just a test to see how you're going to respond. An opportunity, you can say it like that, but it also tests us in the sense that we don't always just automatically come up to the mark. But all it is just one opportunity after another to find out. And that's what Swami says. He says, a test is anything that challenges one's attunement to God. And that is, I think, the best way to think about it. Anything that is strong enough to shake your equanimity, to make you question your relationship with God or feel less in tune, causes you to doubt your faith, doubt yourself, or lose that inner sense of relationship. And after a while, the details become very uninteresting, because it doesn't matter if you have an unwholesome attraction, if you're having financial problems, if your body's giving you a problem, if you're just dealing with psychological chaos, if your family's giving you a hard time. It doesn't really matter what it is. The only thing that's actually happening is it's big enough to disturb your sense of attunement and your equilibrium. And in that sense, it's very helpful, because one also realizes when you think like that, that even though part of the way you may extricate yourself, and he recommends it, is by introspection and understanding, in the end, if you can just change your consciousness and get your attunement back, it doesn't really matter. There's a balance line there, because sometimes people become very ungrounded. They become very unreal, and they won't relate to things as they're really happening, and they won't relate to their own actual reactions to things. They'll just keep insisting that they're just going to stay in tune with God. In here, Swami talks about the fact that you have to use very careful discrimination. It's not always easy to understand why a test is happening. So on one hand, there's this generic reality, and then on the other hand, you have to be very careful in your discrimination, because if you decide that the test is about something that it's not really about, I know there's one friend of mine who has a strong tendency to be very too austere, to try to solve every problem with more austerity, whereas my own opinion of the direction that would be beneficial would be to just relax a little and just sort of take things as they come. But whatever test comes to that person, their response is always to be more rigid about things. And that's, I think, a lack of discrimination as to why this is happening. It's not that you're just supposed to be more of what's not working. Sometimes the way Swami puts it is, we often think that a test is a test of our determination to achieve a righteous goal, when actually it's a test of our discrimination to tell that that's not really a righteous goal. So it's, and you can't make rules about this. I know I got a letter from someone who asked me a very complicated spiritual question, and when I parsed the question apart, what I wrote back to him was, look, what you're really asking here is for rules of behavior that you can always apply instead of developing the intuition to know what God wants. And I can't provide them for you, because you're on the wrong path if that's what you really want. You know, there are paths that will just tell you how you're supposed to behave. And you don't have to have any discrimination. I mean, it followed in a very dogmatic way. You just meet the standard of behavior and you've apparently met God's will. But on our path, what's trying to be, and Swamiji says here, it's a refining aspect. To be tested is to refine ourselves, to have experiences that are complicated enough that our discrimination is honed, our attunement is honed, our ability to be creative in our solutions, our intuition. And so we're always being refined. This is where a couple of weeks ago when Arthur asked a question, and he was asking when at a certain point is a karma finished, and I was responding by saying it's more like a spiral staircase that you climb, and it's better not to declare any particular reality, but each time a challenge to your equanimity comes, that instead of trying to fit it into a box that you've already been through, is to really ask yourself in this moment, what is this asking of me and where is it going? In Swami Kriyananda's life, when he went to see Master in September 12, 1948, and Master asked him, Swami writes this in one of his autobiographies, autobiographical writing, Master asked him, he was a 22-year-old boy, he asked him, of the three major delusions, sexuality, intoxicants, and money, what are you attached to? And Swamiji said, money's never meant anything to me. Intoxicants, I've never been interested. He said, I do have an attraction towards sexuality. And then he said, a few minutes later, Master initiated him as a monk. So he just figured that was the answer to the question. And for the next 30-some years, Swamiji lived as a monastic, even after he was thrown out of the monastery and had to live completely on his own in America, which is not easy. But then at a certain point in 1980, 1981, the Ananda community was becoming very warped. We had like 130 people in the monastery or something like that. No, that's wrong. There were maybe 60 in the monastery, just men and women together. But the majority of the community was monastic. We had a very small householder group. The householders felt like they didn't really have a place. It was very confusing. And the whole community was not going the way it was supposed to go. Many people were joining the monastery for good intention but wrong motive, more like if I'm serious, this is what I should do, rather than a feeling from inside themselves that this is what really what God wanted them to do. And so Swamiji was praying to Master about that question, you know, what to do. And he was had a dilemma because he said to Master in his prayer, as he writes this later, everything about Ananda has been defined by me. He said, and now I'm trying to define a spiritual householder's life. He said, how is this going to work? And Master said, well, you should get married. That's what he felt internally. And Master's response, Swami's response was, but sir, I'm a monk. And he felt Master say, it doesn't matter. This is what you should do. So all of a sudden, the guidance was completely different. And if he had been dogmatic in his guidance, if he'd thought of things only in terms of the past and not the present, it would have just been out of the question. When I was in a situation, not about marriage or monasticism, but when I was working on the incorporation of Ananda as a California city, and we went through this huge 18-month process that culminated in a complete defeat by the political board that had to make the vote, and the defeat was a completely... they broke all the rules, because they allowed Ananda's religious convictions to come into the discussion and to a large extent determine the outcome. And so we felt we had extremely good grounds to appeal and to file a lawsuit and so on like this. And we'd really been wronged. And so we were completely set on doing that. We were talking to the press and completely set on doing it. And then all of a sudden, Swami just announced that we weren't going to go forward. That even if the board making the decision had made it on incorrect grounds, Swami still felt it was the right decision. He said there is a good reason for church-state separation, and in something that was actually very, prescient, seeing into the future. He said when a group organized for one purpose begins to use its organization for another purpose, especially when a group organized for religion begins to use its energy politically, he said, danger always ensues. And that's what you see exactly in our culture right now, that groups organized for religion have become political and it just makes a mess. So he said it really was, he says, I don't believe that Ananda would abuse it, but it could be abused. That's how he put it. I don't think we would, he said, but it could happen. Anyway, Swami made that decision just like that because he was meditating and he prayed to Master about the situation, and he felt immediately, don't go forward, stop now. So I said to Swamiji, I'm the one working on this project, how come I didn't get the message? And his response was, did you ask? I said, no, sir, I just assumed we should keep going forward. And he said, well, and he just went, well, like that. And I laughed, and that was the end of the discussion, because I had presumed that whatever happened yesterday was also true today. And one of the reasons that tests keep coming to us is that it's not always the same answer. We may have learned, maybe we needed to learn strength in one side and then we need to learn flexibility. Maybe for a while it's to hold the line and then after that it's to realize I don't have to hold the line so rigidly anymore. I don't mean foolishly, but rigidly might be in your decisions or something like that. So anything that pulls away your equanimity, don't be too quick to say what the answer is. Otherwise you just get old and you get brittle. And you get uncreative, and that will take you off the path very fast too. Or else, if you're still on the path, you still become a psychological antique, and then you have to die. So that you can wipe the slate clean. That's what Master said. People become psychological antiques, and they just have to be taken away to the astral world so they can kind of loosen up a little and start over again. We've been doing our class, this also parallel to this, about death and dying, and many of the people in that class have never sat around for 7 weeks and talked about death and dying, and they have not been in the company of a few of us who are just so casual about it, and some are enjoying it and some are totally freaked. It just depends, but that's just the way it is. And Master talks about it. It's the most natural thing in the world. Money, sex, death. These are all things that we just can't be delicate about. We have to just be able to look life in the face and go on. Okay, let's see what we want to do here. Just a second. Swami also makes the interesting point that, you know, everybody in the world faces problems. It's one of the most common things that happen. But most people who don't have a spiritual context don't understand that there's an underlying unifying purpose behind our problems. And that's the difference between being a devotee and not being a devotee. It's not that being a devotee, it's easier. But being a devotee, when things happen, you recognize where you're going and why this is taking place. Whereas people without that context just try to solve this problem and then hope that none ever arise again. And then solve this one and hope that none ever arise again. And often they become quite defeated by life because it's just too many difficulties. Whereas the devotee always knows, oh, good, God is playing with me. Here comes another one. Because all I'm ever really is honing my consciousness. And so we know what a test is, whatever it is. Swami said, all problems are tests. Because all problems just tempt us to feel anxious, you know, to feel underconfident, to feel that the world's against us, all the different temptations that we have. You know, I've shared with you in the last few weeks that I had this feeling, which has now lifted, interestingly, but I had this feeling of a strong external negativity pushing on me that I wondered if it was astrological. I don't follow my horoscope, but you know, I was joking that my moon had gone into Hades because that's what it felt like. But I watched that energy try to persuade me to take it personally. I watched it try to insinuate itself into my consciousness sufficiently that I would become personally upset. And I can't say that I've moved through these last few weeks as easily and cheerfully as I can sometimes. But I think I succeeded in the sense that I was always conscious of it as an external force. And I rarely allowed it, occasionally, but I rarely allowed it to feel like it was me. And it was a sort of interesting little trial run. And Swamiji writes in here about always keeping in mind the difference between the difficulty you're having and yourself. He talks about it in terms of temptations. Temptations being to do those things which you know are not going to make you happy in the end, but that you don't understand it sufficiently to really not want to do it. I know some people have a habit. This man had a bad habit of whenever you would talk to him, especially when you would make positive suggestions that he wasn't following, he would always say, yes, yes, I know, like that, as if he was affirming that. And once Swamiji just interrupted him and said, no, you do not know. If you did know, you wouldn't be behaving this way. And it's a bad habit to say that. It's a bad habit to just thoughtlessly say, oh, I know, because we don't. If we really did know, but there is a level, and he emphasizes that, there's a level, I mean, there's a higher level. There's a level where we do understand, but not enough to not want to do it. And this is part of the discrimination, to just sort of watch this interesting conflict within ourselves, that part of us is knowledgeable and then part of us isn't. And it's wiser to call a spade, instead of feeling that somehow it's more appropriate to claim that you really do understand this, because if you did understand it, you wouldn't do it. It's just as simple as that. We don't do anything that we know is going to hurt us if we really know it's going to hurt us. And so we might have the theory in our mind that this is going to hurt us, but then nonetheless, there's some other part of us that's just going to try it one more time. And they just hope that this is going to be different, or doesn't really care, is willing to take the short term, you know, the moment of glory for the long term suffering. I mean, we all face it, eating unhealthy foods, if we have substance addictions, saying unkind words, whatever it might be, laziness, all of these things. If we really knew that it would make us happier to get up earlier and do a full sadhana, we simply would. One of my friends was a very great affirmer. I didn't know this about her for years, but I found out later. She would always set her alarm for 4:30 in the morning, wake up, reset it for 6. But she never gave up. She would just do it. Nitai, when we were living all in Ananda Village, and we were so poor. I mean, we were poor on a level that now when people are poor, I mean, some people are that poor, but we were so poor. On the other hand, we were totally wealthy because we had places to live, we had friends, we had work, we had life, but we had very little money. So money was a really big deal. And money on the level of buying flashlight batteries, you know, that level of money. So Nitai used to get himself out of bed in the morning because he said he played one fault against another. One fault was the desire to lay in bed longer. The other fault was being extremely frugal to the point of being really cheap. So he had a flashlight, and when he would wake up in the morning, he would turn on his flashlight, then he would throw it across the room. Well, it wasn't very far, but it was farther than he could reach without getting out of bed. And then he would have to lie there and watch the batteries run down. And the anxiety over that would usually get him out of bed. And then once he'd gotten out of his bed, then he could keep going. I always loved that. But that's how you work with yourself. You work with yourself humorously. You play. You realize, this is just a challenge to, you know, to my gradually understanding where my happiness really comes from. And of course, if you can play when the stakes are low, if you can develop a good sense of humor about yourself when it's easier, then when it gets a lot worse and things happen that are really not immediately so funny, you can still bring into play the same sense of humor just by realizing that really, if I could laugh about that, I can also laugh about this. It's all really just the same thing. It's look how caught up I am in this delusion and how confused this thought has made me. It's not really any different, whatever it might be. It's the same, you know, basic flow of energy. It's just a matter of degree. That was when we were talking about sexuality. It's just life force, but it's life force that really seems to have a mind of its own and just, you know, gets you going. But if you really can just stand back and realize this is really just misdirected life force, there's not anything else happening here. And it's true. Even if we're totally engaged in something, it's just misdirected life force. Or karma, which is past tendencies, he says, previous failures and weaknesses, just the law of cause and effect, you know, acting itself out. The law of cause and effect is part of the way God made this world. It was made dual. If the energy goes to one side, it has to go back to the other. And this is, it's God-given, this cause and effect. And then we're given the free choice about how we want to play out that cause and effect. And what we get to learn is that actions have consequences. And even if we don't remember the actions, if we're experiencing the consequences, we can be absolutely certain that the actions were also there. Now, sometimes the test, you see, this is why you don't always know, is not to feel bad about that. Oh, look, you know, everybody's mistreating me in such a terrible way. I must have done terrible things. Well, maybe you did do terrible things. But what is the test now? The test now is to not identify anymore with the mistakes of the past, but to realize that even if I had to pay off that karma, so to speak, that's not who I am now. I'm finishing that debt and I'm not making any new ones. I know once when this woman and I had this terrible karmic conflict, just terrible. And I've told you all about this before, but I dreamt our past lives in which she had done just god-awful, gothic movie kind of things to me. And then when she heard about that, which I didn't tell her, I don't know who told her, she went to a psychic and found out the god-awful, gothic movie things that I'd done to her. And I believed that both sides of the story were true, both because of the intensity of both our personalities and the way we responded to each other in this incarnation. And, you know, we were just building the whole thing up. It was getting a big dust storm around it, and Swami just sat us down. And his perception was so perfect. He said, even if all of this is true, and then he added, and I'm inclined to believe it is, he said, neither of you would ever behave like that now. It was just such an obvious comment that this was history. This wasn't reality. You know, the past lives of all men are dark with many shames. And Swamiji will talk about his own past, especially, I was reflecting recently, he'll say, you know, I had shunned Bhrighu. Bhrighu said that I attained shanti in my vrittis, is what he said. Peace in the vrittis. I mean, yoga is the neutralization of the vrittis in the chakras. So what he was saying is that at least sabbakalpa samadhi, very high state of consciousness, that's what that must mean. But then I argued with my guru and I fell. That's what Bhrikkhu said to him. And you fell and you had to wander until this lifetime when you met Yogananda. Now you'll be freed. That's what Bhrikkhu said to him. But Swami just tells us so casually, you know, I was very advanced and then I argued with my guru and I fell. It's like, there you are. But you can see, even as he says it, that he can say it so casually because it doesn't have anything to do with him. He had that experience, he learned that lesson, so now here he is. So what's the point? On a few occasions, Swami Kriyananda has, on more than a few occasions, but on a few particular occasions, Swamiji has just said very sort of frank and open things about people, either when they're in the room or not in the room. And sometimes people get so excited about it, have gotten so excited. And Swami's response has been, what is all this delicate protection of the ego? And even, you know, in our culture, this belief that we have to protect each other's egos. Like, where does that come from? You know, where does that come from? That's just habit. That's not true spirituality. Why should we be so protective? We read about Master in Sri Yukteswar's ashram. We think it's so inspiring. And then somebody just does the tiniest little touch of our little protected things and we all freak out. And we freak out for each other. But why? That's not us. In fact, even if it can be stated in the present moment, it's really not us. We're already committed to overcome it. So even if, I often like to say, there's two kinds of realities. They're the actions that we commit and the actions we are committed to. And the actions that we commit are often not the actions we are committed to. And just because we commit it doesn't mean it defines us. It's the one that's still hanging out there because of past weaknesses, but we no longer have any commitment to it. So even if it's a something we would rather not be happening, we don't have to be so involved in it. And often that's the only challenge of a test, is just to be impersonal enough about it that the mere fact of its existence does not interrupt our attunement with God. And I used to always plunge into these terrible states of guilt whenever my faults were pointed out. And it took me many, many years. And Swami told me many times that guilt is not the same as reformation. You know, it's not really changing yourself. It's just being so embarrassed and so upset because you're not already perfect. But it doesn't really have anything to do with striving for that perfection, because part of what will help you to achieve perfection is to be impersonal enough about what's happened that you can just stand at a little distance and not have it suck away your attunement to God. Whereas all that guilt and self-pity and helpless tears and all those sorts of things that I used to think were like my way of dealing with it was not dealing with it at all. It was just more deeply committing my ego identity to the failing. The test is to not have it interrupt your attunement with God. Well, Lord, we really made a mess of it there, didn't we? And, well, so let's go on from here. It doesn't have to interrupt your attunement because nothing actually can interrupt your attunement unless you let it. And that's the enormous challenge of all these tests, is that even-minded and cheerful, no matter what happens. There was a story someone was telling me, and I'm not quite sure exactly where it came from, but I remember reading it at one time. I can't quite conjure up the context. It's a book about the Holocaust and about a person involved in it. And it was one of those prison camp situations where everybody was just skeletal and starved. And there was one man who had lived through exactly the same conditions and was essentially healthy. He'd hardly lost weight. And it turns out that this particular man, I believe I have these facts right, he was a Jew, and early on in his life in Europe, very early on, the Nazis came through wherever he was, and he and his family were taken somewhere, and right in front of his eyes, his wife and children were killed. And just like that. And in that instant, he realized that he could be angry and bitter and sad for the rest of his life. Or he could just attune himself to a different level. I'm not quite sure how he explained it. But he could choose love. He could choose selfless service. And then when he subsequently went into the camps and all the things that people had to go through, unfailingly he was serviceful. He just defined himself entirely as giving to everybody that he could give. And as a consequence, he remained robust. Not only in his consciousness, but even in his body. I mean, now that's a test. That's meeting a test at the crest. Instead of just waiting until it dies away, he met it right at the crest. Viktor Frankl was a little bit like that too. Viktor Frankl, his wife, he was like 24. He had a beautiful wife and her mother, and they all lived together. And both of the women, he didn't know this. They were separated at the beginning, and they were both killed. He communed and conversed with his wife a lot during the 4 or 5 years that he was in a concentration camp, but he didn't know she was communing from the astral world. It wasn't until later that he found that out. But he watched, as it was going there, he watched people bargaining for their lives. You know, here are the diamonds that I've, you know, put in the lining of my coat. And for him, his wealth was his intellectual work, and he had a doctoral thesis or something. What he was hiding under his coat was his intellectual work. And at a certain point, one of the guards just opened his coat and grabbed all those papers. I mean, this is before computers and Xerox machines, so the papers are destroyed, all the work is destroyed. They just grabbed it and threw it on the trash heap. And he, in that instant, again saw, either I cling to that which is being ripped away from me, or I just go into myself and live in this reality. I live in whatever comes to me, you know, and let go of everything else. And that's a test. And what Swamiji says in here, which is really interesting, you know, God tests us. Tests come from karma, but tests also come from God. When you get on the spiritual path, Divine Mother asks how serious you are and deliberately challenges our seriousness. Just like if you were a teacher and you had a student, you would want to know how serious that student is. How much energy should I put into you? Are you just wasting my time, or are you really going to do it? You know, if you're going to have an assistant or a protege or a piano student, how much energy are you really going to put into this? I'm not going to give you a lot of energy if you're just playing around. So we finally turn our attention to God after all these incarnations of indifference. Divine Mother will ask you, how serious are you? And the way she asks you is she tests you. She'll test our sincerity. Sure, everybody can be on the spiritual path if nothing is asked of you. And this is, again, everybody's so delicate. Oh, let's not talk about this. Let's not talk about that. Let's just pretend that everything can go on just normal. And as I said, I myself have never liked the thought, oh, I took Kriya and now my whole life has fallen to pieces. I don't like the juxtaposition. But Swami writes in here that when you get on the spiritual path, sometimes a lot of things begin to happen because you get into a relationship with God and you're really trying to develop yourself. But if you take a course of study, you sign up at Stanford to get a PhD, you expect to work. You know, we sign up with Divine Mother to become God realized. Did we expect that nothing would ever happen? Did we expect that we're all just so fine right now that nothing would ever happen? Some very popular, you know, pop culture kind of teacher, not a realized master, but in his clever way, he said, look, if you fight to keep your delusions, here's what you get. You get to keep them. You know, like, is that a prize you really want? So when Divine Mother demonstrates to us by our responses that we have a lot to learn, is she punishing us? Or is she helping us? And do we respond by saying, wow, I have a lot of work to do? Or do we respond by getting into the corner and crying because we have a lot of work to do? Or if we, I mean, a friend of mine who's been through some very difficult times and really had her faith profoundly shaken for a while, came to me recently and said, I'm so glad it all happened because I just wasn't holding on to God and Guru the way I should have been holding on. And when my life was really threatened, first I broke the wrong way, but then I broke the right way, and now everything is so much better than it ever would have been. You know, and we also, this is a long situation. Some incarnations are easier than others. Some are more cheerful than others. And you just don't know which one you're in. Some periods of time are easier than others. Everything changes. I often joke when things are good, I always want to whisper it, wow, things are really good right now. So that when they're really terrible now, you also have in your mind, oh, look, they come and they go, they come and they go. come in the go. I've said when we were having to go to Redwood City Courthouse every day to, you know, live through the most outrageously undharmic lawsuit, perhaps I'm going to exaggerate, in the history of the world that we had to live through. It was terrible. It was just a terrible experience. And I said to David, thank God I've had good times, you know, because I know the good times will return, and this is the terrible period. But I never thought of quitting. I just helped me to say out loud, wow, this is the terrible period. But it didn't really have to change my faith in God or my relationship with God. It just meant everyday life was a little less pleasant. We had to do things that were unpleasant. We had to spend time in places we didn't enjoy being with really, really icky people. But these things happen. And is that enough for you to not, you know, not want to be with God? I know a woman left our community once because, not once, but people have left. This woman left because she was mistreated by a less than competent manager. And someone was trying to defend her decision on the basis of the fact that she was mistreated by a less than competent manager. I said to the friend talking to me, would you ever have left your community and your spiritual path because you were mistreated by a less than competent manager? And that friend, to her own credit, said, no, of course not. It would never even cross your mind. You would just think, wow, I'm being mistreated by a less than competent manager. Isn't that interesting? Because these things happen. You know, I wonder who I mistreated in the past. And I wonder how I'm going to deal with this. But to leave over such a thing? You know, people will come to this temple and then they'll vaporize. You know, we won't see them for 6 months. And then they'll say, oh, well, so-and-so spoke rudely to me or somebody was unkind. And I do my best to overcome that. And I certainly don't endorse people being unkind. But part of me also says, oh, well, be careful, you're going to have a real test. I mean, this is like, why are you here? Are you here so that, because people do come. They come to the spiritual path, and they'll come to Ananda because we're awfully nice. You know, we're exceedingly nice. And we listen, and we're not judgmental, and we're supportive, and we're, you know, very open. So people will think, wow, I found my cushy spot on the planet, and I'm just going to hang out here because it's comfortable. But that's no reason to be on the path. That's not being on the path. And then some little thing will happen to show that that's not where we're going, and people will bail. I don't hold it against them. I mean, Ananda's not for everyone. And people will do exactly what they can do. But we should understand, if we're serious about this, that's not what it's about. You make a commitment to God and Guru, and then you just see what happens. You don't say what's going to happen. You just see what happens. And you find it intensely interesting. That doesn't mean you never think. That doesn't mean everybody's always right. That doesn't mean there isn't a time to stand up. You see, you don't know what the test is. Sometimes the test is to just say, how dare you talk to me like that? Nobody talks to me like that. And then that's what you're supposed to do. I've heard Swami on several occasions. This one woman, she was married for 7 years to this man, and after 7 years, she finally decided she would leave him, and she said every time she would meditate, he would turn on the television as loud as he could turn it on. Swami said, 7 years? He said, I wouldn't have taken that for 5 minutes. Just out of the question. It's not that you're always nice. You have to discriminate what the question is and then respond appropriately. Remember in the autobiography, when the woman who was destined that they wanted to marry to Master married his cousin instead. And then Master went back in 1936 and she was a shrew. And his cousin was, as he put it, tiptoeing around the house so as not to upset her. And Master took the woman aside and he said, I have a certain right to speak because you were supposed to be my wife. I said, I want to tell you, if you had treated me like that, I would have left for the Himalayas in the first week. It's not always that you just give in. But you have to use your discrimination, what's happening here. Okay. Swami also says, which is very interesting, one of the reasons sometimes God sends us lots of tests is so that we can work out our karma more quickly. And that was just like, oh, that's an obvious and important thought, isn't it? Once you're on the spiritual path, we want to get on with it. We don't want to just have, you know, 100 more lifetimes. We just want to get the project done. And so karma can speed up. And God will just start dumping a lot more into one incarnation because let's just get it done. And once we understand that whatever is coming to me will inevitably come to me, why not now? You know, why be looking for a soft birth? And of course, sometimes we have a desire for a soft birth, but if we really understood, we wouldn't want that. So we have to be honest, we have to be sincere, but then we need as strongly as possible to bring ourselves back to where we want to be. And Master, in autobiography, in Swami's a book about Master, he talked about one of the Prema Moy or Ananda Moy just had a series of one small problem after another. And then Master said, "That's good." He said, we want real devotees here, not doctors of delusion, which is what he called the DD degree. Doctors of divinity, it's called. No, Master said, we don't want doctors of delusion. We want real devotees here. So that's good. That's good that one thing after another is happening to you because all the karma is getting worked out. That's just a nice way to think about it. Oh my, I just got my head above water and here comes another one. That's good because it's all getting worked out. And God must really, you know, want me to grow. He's really helping me. And Swami emphasizes very strongly, if you meet your tests with the right spirit, God gives you the energy to go through them. And you're never tested beyond your capacity to endure, perhaps right to the limit, but not beyond, because if you meet it with the right attitude, God gives you the grace. And I was commenting in some, maybe it was here, I don't remember, in some group, how often people will say, when you feel your worst, people will tell you you look your best. Because often the intensity of your effort to hold your equanimity actually creates an aura of grace around you and a brightness to your eyes and a kind of firmness to your energy that might not be there at all if everything's going easy and you're just kind of drifting through and there's no particular magnetism around you. But often the effort to face and overcome difficulties. And everybody around you will feel it. I mean, it's a joke. It's like a joke in our community because you're just having, you know, a really god-awful day and that's the day that everyone tells you how well you're doing. You've just been shining lately, they'll say. Wow, isn't that interesting? But I've been through it enough to know that it's actually true. Because if you're taking it with the right attitude, even if you're not feeling so well, the energy will still be there. Swami talks about when he was thrown out of SRF in 1962, and then in 63 he started speaking again and giving concerts. And the first time he really spoke in public after his expulsion from SRF, people talked about what joy they felt from him. And he said joy was the last thing he was feeling. But then he said he had to realize that underneath what was for him the most intense pain he'd ever experienced, there was still this underlayer of bliss. Because no matter how awful it is, we know who we are and we know where we're going. People who fall into real despair don't know where they are and don't know where they're going. But that's worth everything. And if you cling to that, God just helps you. And just like a master wrote in his time with Sri Yukteswar, when he stopped being so sensitive about Sri Yukteswar's criticisms, for one thing, they stopped, but it became a completely different experience. Every time anything happened, he would just say, well, here we go again. I remember when he was in front of a very large group of people, he was bringing Master a glass of water, and he tripped on the edge of the rug, a Sri Yukteswar glass of water. And Sri Yukteswar said about Master, oh, you clumsy oaf. And the whole room laughed. And Master looked at them and he said, laugh if you like, but not one of you has received from this guru what I have received. What difference does it make? This is not at all the same, but it was an interesting experience for me. When Richard Salva lived here, we used to do these little skits he would write. And remember, he wrote a skit based on Star Trek. And the big funny thing was that he put me in one of those little Star Trek outfits. And I was Commander Praver, and I came in at the end of the thing. And it was when we were still on California Avenue. Do you remember that? And I played myself, essentially, and I led some little meditation and solved the big problem. And then the Star Trek Enterprise ship was saved and so on. And it was pretty authentic. We had these little authentic costumes and people, I don't follow that, but everybody who knew, it was all, we had all the right people there. Well, I walked out, and I'd kept a secret that I was in it, and I walked out on stage in this little stretch suit that you wear, and all gussied up to be this character, and the whole room just began to laugh. And they laughed, and they laughed, and they laughed. I mean, they, you know, just full out, sort of knee slapping, falling on the floor laughter, for no reason except that I was standing there in this ridiculous getup and was about to do this ridiculous thing. It was fascinating for me to just stand there and have everybody, I mean, they were laughing with me, but they were also really laughing at me. And just to be the object of everyone's humor. It was really quite fun because there was such a tendency to want to defend yourself against it, you know, and just go back and change into your real clothes and just get out of this absurd situation. But also just to relax and just let it happen. It was very instructive in the end to just watch the feelings inside of me. I wouldn't call it a big test, but it wasn't nothing either. I did decide never to do that again, I must add. But still, it was very, very interesting, you know, how we play out all these different sides of ourselves at different times. Now let me see what else. Okay, let me ask if there's any questions, and then if not, we'll take a little break before we finish. Any questions or comments about anything that was said?
Thank you. I've had lots of tests lately. One thing after the other. I've tried to stay even-minded and cheerful as best I can. Not so easy. But I thought, well, Sarah, you're getting a little older, and you don't have that much time to be in this body, so Master is really wanting to give it to you and help you out.
That's exactly right.
I'm not doing that great with it, but it helps a little bit to think that. I mean, I don't know what else to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think just what you're saying, I was relating to everything.
Yeah, it's very, very good. It's the only way to deal with it. You know, this is not exactly what you said, but it's a beautifully inspiring story from Nitai that I've always been so moved by. There was a point maybe 10 or 15 years ago when Ananda, the first generation of people who really started Ananda, my generation, we were in our 20s, and you know, we didn't think about the future. We trusted God. It wasn't that we didn't think about the future. It was just we were doing this for God, and where there is Dharma, there is victory. That was basically it. And then everybody's begun to age, and the thought has crossed people's mind, the concept retirement plans, you know, things like that. So there was some meeting at Ananda Village, and it was a little bit of a mixed energy about retirement plans and, you know, what Ananda would owe people who worked, gave their life to Ananda. And I wasn't present, but this is what I was told that Nitai said, who's been, you know, is really a renunciate. He said, my commitment was always to God and Guru. He said, I never made a deal with Ananda. I never expected that anybody would give me anything back. I just gave to God and Guru, and that's what I'm for. For, he said, if at the end of my life God puts me under a bridge, that's where God puts me to live, and that's just the way it's going to be. You know, it's just like he didn't want to have any part of this. Somebody owes me something. That's like you either give your life to God and trust. You can't trust because you've hedged your bet. You either trust or you don't trust. That doesn't mean you're impractical. That doesn't mean you're foolish. But just that's how he put it. I mean, in practical terms, we're a community, we'll work together, we'll try to figure it out. The chance of Nitai ending up, you know, living under a bridge and not one of the four generations of students that he's been teaching his entire life would come and rescue him seems exceedingly remote. But in his own mind, he's not thinking that they owe me. He's thinking, I've given my life to God and Guru and it's not my problem now. And you know, I've given my life to God and to Divine Mother, and how she treats me is really, it's not up to me. That's a decision for management. they just treat me the way they're going to treat me. And that's what I was saying earlier. What is our commitment and why are we committed? That's why every test is really the same. What am I really committed to? And why am I committed to it? When I first moved, when Swami first had us move here from Ananda Village in 1987, he... Swami Kriyananda still lived at Ananda Village at that point. Later he moved to Italy, but not for a long time. And so I was really removed from my childhood home and from the from my spiritual childhood home and from his proximity. And that was really tough on me, because I had really been, our house was right next door to his. I had just been accustomed my whole spiritual life to being right in his aura all the time. And he was still there, and that opportunity was still there. It had just been taken away from me. So the first couple of years here were really rough. And he came to visit really often, which I loved, but every time he would leave, I would cry. And then it crossed my mind that God had put me where God wanted me to be. And if I picked myself up and took myself someplace else, I wouldn't find there what I'd hoped to find. That I would only find what I hoped to find, which is attunement with God in the place where God has put me. And even though, you know, there was still a pang, the whole orientation was different. Which is, if this is what God sends me, okay, this is what I have to deal with. And why do I think I would be happier with something else? You know, what am I committed to and why? And once you start going that way, the word test doesn't even mean anything to you. There's no such concept as a test. When people talk to Swamiji sometimes about how hard his life has been, he says, I don't think so. You know, like, how? Why do you say that? And then people will enumerate all these things. Well, they were just things that had to be dealt with. They did have to be dealt with, but why define them as a problem or even a test? It's just a situation that's been given to you, and then you deal with it. Why color it with thoughts like that? Well, let's take a little break.
Well, my life has been, I don't know, relatively comfortable, I suppose. But, and so to me, the test I've always had, it started out to just wanting to stay alive. And then it came to being happy. And now I've kind of understand that it's to be connected with God.
Right.
And so it's like one constant test. Uh-huh. I don't look at it like this test, that test. This
right.
It's like everything, the whole day is a test to just stay focused on God.
Well, that's actually a very good way to think about it, because all that's happening, we really have only two choices in our life, the masters often say. We either are conscious of God's presence in our life, or we lose touch with that. And nothing else, everything else is a detail.
Yeah,
so if that's how it feels to you, that's a great way for it to feel.
Okay, because it's confusing when I hear people. I mean, someday I'm going to probably get sick or something bad's going to happen, but I don't know. What's happening now seems like as much of a test as anything that could possibly happen in the future.
That's just a very good way to look at it. You know, my own life, nothing happens to me. People are always asking. I mean, maybe someday something will, but people are always asking me, how are things? Same, you know. I met Swami early, I went to Ananda, I've worked hard all my life, and my fight is against tamoguna. It's always just to keep my energy as high as I can and to do what I'm supposed to do. And after that, it's just a pretty dull story. But that's enough.
Yeah.
And it's the same. Every day's just the same.
It's good when it can be a dull story.
Absolutely. I'm perfectly happy with my dull story.
Yeah.
If God wants to make it more dramatic, that's his choice, but he's not decided to do it so far, so we'll see what happens. You know, some people's stories are so dramatic with, you know, deaths and changes and displacements and adventures. And you know, David, my husband David, once also, he just said something that I've always really enjoyed. I'm not much on astrologers or psychics or things like that, but every once in a while I'll get an astrological reading, I'll become curious. And every once in a while I've dragged David to astrologers. I say dragged because he accepts, but he never listens. And I dragged him to a reading, which, as it happened, was not very good anyway. The astrologer seemed to think it was his job to know things and keep them from us. So he would make it clear that he knew, but he just tried to tell us as little as possible. But when we came, that was part of the reason, but we came out and David just looked at me and he said, let's not waste money on that anymore. And then his answer was just, I've loved it. He said, it doesn't make any difference. He said, I get up every day, I do the best I can do. He said, I'm not going to try less hard or more hard. I'm doing the best. Every day I try to do the absolute best I can do. What difference does it make? And I really like, absolutely, that's it. What difference does it make? One of my very early acquaintances on the spiritual path, he was a friend at the time. I talked, it's on Sunday, about when I was 18 turning 19 and we got the books about Vivekananda, and I had a little coterie of friends. It was right here in Palo Alto, actually. And we were in Los Angeles first, but then we were up here. How did we get up here? And I can't quite follow that, but we were here. He always just said this phrase. He was one of the people who introduced me to the spiritual path. You just got to make your day. That's how he put it. And I remembered that from being 18. You just got to make your day. That's what he would say. And that's exactly what David said to me. I get up in the morning and I make it the best day I can make it. Everything else is irrelevant. And I mean, I know what that means. That means do your assignments with right consciousness. Yeah. And if you hold that thought, then even when other more mountainous things come in, they won't look to you like big mountains. They'll just look like one more thing that you have to do. Yeah.
Because it just happens moment by moment by moment. It's not like, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. In the moment, it's just exactly what it is.
Yeah.
This day, it's just exactly what it is, and you just do it. And you fight against tamoguna, and you fight to be attuned, and you try to be intuitive, and some minutes are better than others.
Yeah. Nothing has to be dramatic.
Nothing has to be dramatic. Dramatic is when you take it all so personally. Oh, look what's happening to me. Oh, look at this big thing that I have to deal with now. Oh, think of what happened to me yesterday and what might happen to me tomorrow instead of it just happening. Wow, look at that. You know, that was sort of when we were going through that trial. It was such a mess. But, you know, it was just, we just had to get up every day and live through it. What was the point of becoming really, really agitated about it? It was just awful, and there you have it. But no drama. But see, some people enjoy drama. I read something in The Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, Autobiography of a Yogi. I mentioned it briefly at the Guru Retreat, but it wasn't the time to go into it at greater length. Amazingly interesting to me. In the material world, Sri Yukteswar said, people are motivated. They like egocentric, sensual, sense-oriented experiences. So when you're in the material world, you like things that stick to the ego that you can experience. You know, you want good food, you want strong drink, you want dancing that you can really feel in your body. You know, you just want it to be like you can really get your hands on it. In the astral world, you're attuned to the vibrations of things. You love beautiful music, beautiful sounds, beautiful sunsets. You make flowers, you walk through meadows, the rain is like rainbows. And it all has, you're working on a more delicate level because you feel the vibrations of things. On the causal plane, the idea alone is enough. And you just can, I don't know what that means, but you can create universes with your own thoughts. Now, the aspect that's interesting is when you sort of rise from the material commitment to the astral plane, you find the material thing absolutely suffocating. You just can't bear it. When you rise from the astral level to the causal level, you find the causal level just garish. You don't want to be part of it. And then when you even abandon the causal plane and go into the infinite, but what I realize is, of course, even as we live in this world, material world altogether, some of us live more on the astral plane. And so people walk into this room, and for many people on Sunday morning, there is nothing happening in this room. There is just literally nothing happening because there's nothing happening that they can get their material understanding into. Whereas those of us who are attuned to it, we are experiencing vibrations. Because that's the world that we really live in, even though we're in the material world and we're caught by it to a certain extent. But we really live more on the astral plane. We live more on the level of vibrations. And to put us into those really heavy ego-driven, sensorial things are just suffocating. They're horrible. And for such people to come into an atmosphere like this, they're just bored out of their minds. They just can't stand it. They run away as soon as they can. What is with those people? Sitting there, nothing? You know, nothing? Like, what is happening? Nothing is happening. Can you imagine anything more dull than that? But we're experiencing it on the vibration level. Isn't that interesting? And that's how we elevate ourselves. And that's why you want to extricate yourself. You know, that's why drinking and music that's too hard in its beat and experiences that are too much about your body, even if you're doing things that are about your body, dancing or sports or so on, you want to feel them more on the energy and the vibration level. You want to be moving more in that flow than just on the intense physical flow. And so it was very interesting to me. It helped explain people's experience of Ananda and how different it can be, one from another, and helped me understand more who we are in all of this. Interesting, huh? Now that was relevant to something. Well, that was just about the tests are all the same. If we're only living on the level of the vibration, what actually happens in the material world is less important. Because if we can keep the right vibration, it doesn't matter what's going on. Even in the midst of the lawsuit, since I've mentioned it, we laughed a lot. We really, really laughed a lot. The worst day of the lawsuit, when Swami Kriyananda was put on the stand, and just the horrible lawyers were just so rude to him. It's somewhere, and I think it was then, the battery on Swami's hearing aid died, and he didn't even mention it. He just didn't think it was worth mentioning. It was just so pointless what was going on. But when he, you know, the James Bond movies, how James Bond would order his martinis, you know, he always wanted them stirred, not shaken. That's how it was. But anyway, when Swami came out of that horrible thing, and many of us were not allowed in the courtroom because we were witnesses, and so we couldn't be in. We were in the hall. He comes out, and we just rushed around because we'd really felt like we'd given the lamb to the wolves. "How are you, sir?" "Stirred, but not shaken," he declared. So right in the middle of that courtroom, there was a roar of laughter from all of us. You know, it was one of the most satisfying moments of the whole thing. Because why? Even if it's horrible, why let it affect your inner vibration? "Stirred, but not shaken." "Yes, sir." Well, okay. There's a couple of more ideas I'd really like to just focus on for a minute. Swamiji talks about the right balance to come to the right understanding is what he calls impartial reason paired with devotion. And I've had, and he calls it the ability to compare between truth and untruth, between God's joy and false pleasure. And of course, that primarily comes through meditation. He says, reason is rightly guided when the mind has acknowledged the inescapability of divine law, which is a quote from Sri Yukteswar. And sometimes in other contexts, I've talked about the fact that one of the first steps to spiritual maturity is Sri Yukteswar's statement to recognize the inescapability of divine law. And then you stop trying to justify yourself or find a loophole or figure out a way to get out of it. It's just like the karmic law will be fulfilled. Divine Mother's grace will take care of me. My discipleship will work out. It just is going to have to happen. And there's no shortcut. The same man who was asking me for rules, not intuition, was also asking me for a shortcut. And I just wrote, this is one of my letters there. There's two things you're asking me for, two things. Rules, not intuition, and a shortcut. And neither of those things is there. You just, the inescapability of karmic law, of divine law, is that certain actions bring certain results, including even-minded and cheerful brings the grace of God. All of these are part of it. But you begin to try to mold your consciousness to reality instead of trying to force reality to match your desires. And this is where impartial reason, I've had this. And I must confess, there's just a little bit of my own personal point of view in this. I am extremely strong-minded. I am also supremely rational, is how Swami put it to me once. as he put it, I think there's scarcely a man who could hold out against you when you get like that, you know, when I become so reasonable. But I've often seen that people shrink from impartial reason, and they try to justify it in terms of devotion. And they're not really being more heart-centered. They're just afraid to reason something out too clearly. And I admit that in me it's a fault. It could be a fault, because I have to be able to bring it to a clear and reasonable focus. That's how I understand things. And I don't see any conflict between devotion and bringing things to a clear and reasonable understanding. Unbeknownst to me, probably there is at times when I'm not aware of it. But what I really loved here was the simple phrase, impartial reasoning. And both are required. You have to feel it from your heart. But if you only feel it with your heart and don't also put out the energy to reason it out impartially, your feelings are not reliable then. Because if your feelings are guiding you properly, impartial reason will also support it. I don't mean an over-rational approach or anything, but you can just reason impartially. What's really happening here? And are my feelings really representing the highest truth, or is just as how I happen to feel? The feelings are not necessarily the same as intuition. The feelings have to be completely calm. And if they're completely calm, then reason will also support it. And yes, calm feeling comes first, because reason follows feeling. Because calm feeling is the substance of which the universe is made, reason is a manifestation of that. It is not the Satchitananda is not reasonable first. You know, Satchitananda is first, ever conscious, ever new bliss, and that bliss is the feeling side, so that is the foundation. But calm intuitive feeling is not incompatible and is never inconsistent with impartial reason. And if you find your mind rebelling against bringing things to a reasonable focus, you have to ask yourself whether or not you're being impartial, or whether you're allowing your feelings to prejudice your reason. Yes?
Could you give an example of
that?
Of devotion that leads, and then you go into reasoning?
Well, devotion, okay, I'm thinking more of feeling than devotion. True devotion to God is different.
Okay.
But what people get confused about is, well, for example, I was in a conversation with someone, and it was clear that they had allowed their emotions to cloud their judgment. And when they made a pronouncement to me about, this is how so-and-so treated me. And I said, well, what did they do? And then when they actually presented the facts to me, it was quite clear that her conclusions were not valid. That she had reacted to one event and then extrapolated out and had now made a declaration about this woman and how she related to her and what she thought, none of which had any substantial support. And when I tried to work with that, well, she said, I just go by how things feel. And, you know, that sounds good. But in this case, particularly looking right, you know, reason follows feeling. But the feeling was not calm intuition. The feeling was just a desire not to use impartial reasoning. Go ahead.
To a yogi, that doesn't sound good.
No, it's not good. However, do we do it all the time, even as yogis? Mm-hmm. So we have to be a little nice to ourselves on the point. But when you ever hear yourself not wanting to examine something carefully and claiming that you're a bhakti, just be a little careful. Just be a little careful. Just ask yourself, you know, What kind of feeling am I protecting here? And it's true, and I mean, I'll take responsibility. You know, I can become very intense, and so sometimes people will hold, you know, react against that intensity, which is not the same as what I'm talking about. But just be careful. If you can't bring things to a clear focus, ask yourself why. Because impartial reasoning, this is how we understand our tests, is through impartial reasoning. And you may be more heart-oriented, you may flow better with the feelings of your heart, but just be sure you can trust them. Just be sure you can trust it. It's because that's why I was just pleased that he put that point. And of course, that's what Swamiji is like. When I met him, and it's to this day, all the way through, he's just so capable in his intelligence. And I don't just mean he's smart. Many people are smart. But he has such a capable intelligence of solving problems and seeing creative solutions and coming up with new ideas and communicating what he sees. And I actually really meditated on what makes him so brilliant. And I realized that because his heart is so calm, and because his heart is so calm, it doesn't confuse his mind. He can reason extremely impartially because he's not prejudiced. He's not prejudiced in favor of anything. He feels energy, and he'll know what's happening, but he's not prejudiced in favor of anything. He's wrong, he's right, they're right. This is a good thing, that's a bad thing. It's just all out there. He's very impartial. And then he can just apply clear reasoning to the situation because there's no prejudice in his heart. In other words, his intelligence comes from his heart. Reason follows feeling from the courage of the heart. So we need to have that kind of devotion that leads to clarity, not that kind of devotion that becomes a subterfuge for an unwillingness to bring things to a clear focus. And we have the example of Swamiji in this, who is as balanced as a human being can be, but is anything but vague when it comes, you know, to his thought processes and his way of reasoning and understanding things. He doesn't use anything as an excuse. He's entirely impartial. And I find that it's very, very helpful to do that. That's why I talk all the time. I just think it's helpful to just try to get it clear. Because then you have two tools to work with. Why take one of them and put it in the closet? Let's just use both of them. And then you'll be yourself. You know, whatever your dominant way of relating to life is, you'll be that way. Okay, any questions or thought about that?
It always struck me when I first met Swami. When I first met Swami, he would walk like this. It was the oddest thing.
Yeah.
He was afraid of nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
It was just, there was no fear there.
Yeah. He would never, his posture was like a strung bow, just like they talk about it. Straight spine, chest curved, and he would break the plane with his heart. And I've always had a habit and I've had to work against, which is that I push against life from my forehead. And I've had to very consciously try to pull, you know, my intellect back a little bit and just literally not push through life from your head. A lot of people's posture, their shoulders curve, but their shoulders curve actually because they're pulling their heart back. I mean, I don't mean older people, because even Swami's body is curling up a little bit. But oftentimes, you'll see that people will try to protect their heart by pulling it in, and even to the point of curling their shoulders over it. Or people will just lean forward and try to... I mean, I find myself sometimes in conversations, I realize that I'm physically demonstrating the desire to push my ideas, or to push with that. You have to fall back, and you have to just rest in the heart, and then your intelligence becomes impartial, because I was talking about how the heart can confuse the head, but also the head can just confuse itself all by itself. It doesn't necessarily need any help from the heart to get completely mixed up, because you get really divorced from your feelings, and you're just spinning ideas. I know sometimes learning to speak to people in large or small groups, sometimes you'll watch someone. And the way I think about it is the ideas start in their brain, they come out their mouth, but they'll go almost immediately back into their brain. They never go like out into relationship with anyone. Some people converse like that. Their reality never leaves their own brain. These are funny things to watch, but you can see it. They just talk and they're fascinated by what they think. And they love their ideas, but it goes out their mouth back into their own brain, and the audience gives them an excuse, or the company gives them an excuse, but they're never actually impartially engaged. They haven't got the devotion side of it.
How do you get out of that one? I mean, you don't know when to end sometimes.
You rest in the heart. That was Swami's advice. Rest in the heart, and then let everything else come from resting in the heart.
People who have a closed circuit up here have a hard time
finding. Well, life tortures you, and then you begin to come out of it. No, it's just the truth. I mean, I had a friend and an acquaintance, and I used to laugh. I said, you know, she just doesn't know there's anyone else out there. She's talking and communicating all the time, but she really, in truth, doesn't have any idea that there's anybody out there. She was the opposite of Swami's definition of true maturity, being able to relate to realities other than her own. One reality, that was hers. And all of her speech was just like that, go out of her mouth and back into her brain. I mean, I liked the woman perfectly fine. I thought she was immensely entertaining. You know, but it's just interesting. You don't have to do everything. You can also just watch and say, well, to my mind, that's an interesting vibration. What's going on? And then I try to feel it. And as a, you know, as a public speaker, you have to think about those things a lot. Huh. That's when you say people are lost in their own head. That's a slang expression. Oh, he's just always lost in his own head. Well, that's it. His words go out, they go back into his brain, he stirs them up again, and then he brings them out again, you know? And in our society, since they teach us nothing about anything, fundamentally, Living Wisdom School does, you know, they learn to relate. But we can grow up and we can be an outstanding success and never learn anything. But that's not us. We're devotees. Well, I've covered this course, I believe, as well as I need to. Okay, that was fun. That was really fun. Okay, God bless everyone. We did a good job on that one.